Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. You are listening to Voices for Justice. I'm your host, Michelle Bart. And tonight, November 24th, the eve of Thanksgiving 2010, we sit down in an exclusive with a singer, producer, songwriter, survivor, and advocate, Jackie Hollander. The phone lines are open. The call-in number is 347-838-8622. Again, that number is 347-838-8622. The chat room is also going. Please log on to blogtalkradio.com/helpingheroes and click chat, and you'll be able to chat with some of the folks. And if you'd like to ask questions in the chat room, you may do so. And we also have a lot of callers on the switchboard. If you are on the switchboard and you are calling in with a question to our guest this evening, please make sure that you call back and go into the host queue so we know that you are indeed there to ask questions. Otherwise, we won't get to you this evening. Thank you again for everyone being with us. Jackie, welcome to the show. Thank you so much.
Hi, Michelle. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Thank you for being with us. I know it's the night before a national holiday here, but definitely we know that things are happening, things are brewing, and we just want to sit down and talk a little bit about the past, the present, and definitely the future. So let's get right into it. You've worked with Lynyrd Skynyrd, Billy Joel Royal, Atlanta Rhythm Section. You produced and wrote Atlanta Will Be Rocking for the Atlanta Falcons. You've had so many songs that you've written throughout your life, even winning, I believe, the Songwriter of the Year. But in the early 80s, you met the godfather of soul that many of us know him by, James Brown and his wife, Adrienne. Before we get going, I know this is going to be difficult, and if by any means I ask a question that you're not feeling comfortable with, please let me know. But even Adrienne was your best friend. And for our listeners, tell us a little bit about how you met them, how the working relationship with you and Brown became really strong for many years. And let's start there.
Okay. First, I'd like to wish everybody a happy Thanksgiving and tell them thank you for, on a busy night with family, taking the time out to be with us. And so I wish them all a happy Thanksgiving. I actually was doing a record to raise money for children's charities, and it was this song for the Atlanta Falcons, and we had the players singing. It was the first one. It was before before the Chicago Bears actually had their song, the Chicago Shuffle. I had come up with the idea for football players to sing on a record with a national entertainer and a nationally known band. And so we had members of the Atlanta Rhythm Section playing on it with the Falcon football players. And, of course, for our lead vocalist, we had first decided on Ronnie Millsap, and as the song became more, I guess you would say, more funk with the players deciding they wanted more funk, there was a decision made to go after James Brown, the godfather of soul.
And so you brought him in to that project, and then a friendship obviously developed between you and James and his wife at the time, Adrienne. How were things in the beginning of that relationship?
In the beginning, wonderful. I mean, I thought of him like a father. I admired him. you know, I can truthfully say that James Brown was a phenomenal entertainer. There were many good sides to James Brown. There were two sides to him, of course, and I had a lot of respect for him as a entertainer, as a singer. I produced him. I worked with him. I knew him. He became like family to me. His wife was my best friend. And so I would say that working with him was a very, very great, great thing for me. It was an honor to work with him. You know, it was a high point in my life, yes.
You became friends.
You
worked with him. And
yes.
Obviously you had some dreams with him also. And one of those dreams was to start an agency, the I Feel Good Children's Trust, which obviously in recent years has become the center of attention. How did that come to be? And how important was that to both of you and Adrian?
You know, I respect you a lot because you brought Adrian into that, and a lot of people have left her out because she is now deceased. And Adrian was very, very happy. I came up with the idea because Mr. Brown and I were doing so many charitable events. We were raising so much money for children. It became something that I had always done and brought him into it because the record was for children's charities. So that's how it came about. And when I approached him about starting a trust fund, he was elated. He was elated. And Adrian, she was Hispanic and made a point of, you know, saying the Hispanic should be not forgotten too. So, you know, she was very elated. We all were.
So it was a fund established basically for the less fortunate in society, especially children. Were many of your songs, I believe, the royalties also went to that trust. Is that correct?
Yes, I poured everything into it. Everything. My songs, monies that we raised went in it. It was very important because it was what I wanted. It was what he wanted. We were basically partners. We were partners. We were 50-50. And, you know, hence 26 years later, I'm in federal court.
And 26 years later, you're in a position you probably didn't expect to be when all of that came to be years prior. And for the record, before we go on, because I know of one particular member of the media that is listening to this, over the years, you have not spoken to media except for one local reporter. Is that correct?
I did speak to a tabloid. I did do a tabloid interview other than the one, but no, I have not spoken to the media.
Okay. So just to clarify that, because, you know, there's so much speculation out there. I mean, I'll be honest with you, Jackie. When a friend of mine and a colleague asked me to speak with you, of all the shows I've ever had to prepare for, this show in particular, it's mind-boggling of not only documentation from the 80s, but also court records and everything. And it all appeared as if you've done all these interviews, and then when you told me you've never really sat down with media, and yet national media outlets kind of made it seem as if they had spoken to you personally, that's just mind-boggling. So a message to the listeners, please make sure when dealing in any kind of issue or case, you do your research, because I was under the notion that all these interviews that I've seen posted were actually of you and that reporter sitting down, but that's not the case. Let's go to April 1st. Let's go to April 1st, 1988. Police receive a call from Adrian Brown, and then a warrant is issued for attempted murder. Brown had pulled a gunshot, pulled a shotgun on his own wife, tried to kill her, blew up her tires on her car, blew up her mink coat, shot up their home with bullets. And in an interview with People magazine, Adrian mentioned she was concerned for her life and pressed charges against Brown. But in the meantime, hours prior to that, what many people don't know, before trying to kill his wife, Brown allegedly, but most of us know the truth, Brown allegedly raped you and left you for dead in the muddy woods. What was done by police then? And did you press charges? Take us back to that April 1st, 1988 night.
It really started in the afternoon. It was a meeting that I had attended, me, Mr. Brown, Mr. Dallas. There was no reason for me not to go with Mr. Brown. I had never, ever been, of course, alone with him. I saw him leave the building with the shotgun over his shoulder. I never, ever suspected that he would use it on me. It was something that I figured was being carried for his protection, because his security detail was not with him.
The security detail wasn't with him?
No, when we left the building, no.
I didn't think that the security detail or his bodyguards ever left his side.
That's correct. They didn't. But we were only going down the road. And he walked to his van, and I went and threw my bag with my tapes. Everybody knows me. I carry my tapes in a bag. And I threw them in the trunk of my car. And I remember clearly looking over my shoulder and see, to the left, and seeing him come down with the shotgun over his shoulder. And I just thought to myself that it was to protect him. I did not, I was not afraid at that time in any way, shape, fashion, or form. And so I got into the van. He put the shotgun between the seat and the console being in the middle. He put it on the right side, wedged it between the seat and the console.
You okay?
Yep. Yeah, I'm fine. So, you know, then he took me to where we were supposed to go. And, you know, everything was done to, you know, he went to the dealership like he said he was going to do. So I didn't question anything then. When we left from there, we were headed back to the office, but he didn't go. He went to a Texaco station, and he asked me to go in and to get him some hard candy, and I did the Jolly Ranchers, you know, the Jolly Ranchers, that the hard candy,
mm-hmm.
And he did not ask for a specific amount of them. And I went in and I just grabbed a bunch of Jolly Ranchers. And a Coke for him and for me. I went back to the car and he went nuts and started screaming at me and yelling at me. And I started crying because he said that I did not bring him 100 Jolly Ranchers. And he was working with James Brown. He was a perfectionist. It was always like walking on eggshells with him, because you had to be perfect. You had to be so perfect for him. And I was one of the few people that I think broke a barrier as far as I could work with him. And there could be moments where you would be able to slide past that perfection, but not many times. And so... I was very young at that time, and when he started screaming at me like that, of course, the tears started coming down my face, and he demanded that I go back in and get exactly that amount. And I went back in, and I vividly recall the lady behind the counter saying to me, oh, honey, I see... you're with Mr. Brown, the eccentric Mr. Brown. And she said, what is wrong? And I said, I didn't count out enough pieces of Jolly Ranchers for him. He wanted 100. And she started helping to count the Jolly Ranchers for me. And I took them back. And it's 26 years later, and to show you what post-traumatic stress disorder does, it's 26 years later, and I didn't even realize that when I handed him the bag of candy, he never even counted or looked to see that there was 100 pieces of candy in the bag. He just took the bag, and to this day, you know, when I look at Jolly Ranchers, I'm back in that day.
That's a trigger point.
Yes. I have quite a few of them from that day, the daffodils, fans, Woods, the time of season, the day, smells, oddly enough, that day is yesterday for me. 26 years later, I see it as clear today as it was yesterday, or the event, you know, is very clear in my face every second of it. It doesn't seem like 26 years ago for me.
So let me ask you, Jackie. You go into the Texaco. You don't bring enough Jolly Ranchers. So you go back in. The lady helps you count them out. Obviously, he's done this with other people at some point, if the lady behind the counter is familiar with his character. So were you scared at that point,
No. Knowing
he had a gun?
Not at that point. No. No, I wasn't. I thought that he was just being arrogant. I thought that he was just being... I had seen him, you know, and through the sessions, you know, get upset. I just thought he was being arrogant. And so, you know, I got into the van, and at that point when he left the Texaco, that is when I saw him pass the road to go back to the office and go onto the expressway. And I knew then that he was not taking me back. And it wasn't until he started speeding really fast that he had asked me for a cigarette. And I gave him one of mine, and he puffed on it, and he said it was too strong. And he said, he put his hand, and he said, behind the seat is my wife, get one of my wife's cools. And I reached behind and got the cigarettes, and I handed it to him, and he started puffing it. And at that moment in time is when I noticed he has started turning his head to the left and to the right, and his sides of his cheek started quivering.
What did that indicate? Was he drinking and driving? And
no, he was.
You said you
bought
him a
Coke. Not a drinker.
Oh, he was not a drinker. Okay.
I was not.
Was he on any type of drugs at the time? Was he acting erratically that way, or was this just his personality when he was upset about something?
I actually thought that he was having a stroke. I actually thought he was having a stroke. I did. I didn't know what was going on with him. I knew something was very strange. That and it wasn't until he started speeding very fast that I started thinking to myself. I asked him where he was going, and he said, "I will show you." And when I saw his face twitching, I became afraid. And when he started speeding and telling me that the government was behind us, I became very concerned. He told me...
The government?
Yes. He told me that the trees were blowing, and they were not. They were still. I knew it was not going to be... I was scared, but I didn't at that moment in time... have fear of being hurt. I was more afraid of him crashing the van and killing us.
Hallucinations like that sound like, I don't know, Coke or LSD or something.
Well, you have to understand, when you don't see someone ingest something or do something, and they start behaving erratically, you can't know what is going on. You're only there, and you are observing. To see a human being start losing their mind is a very scary thing. I don't think many people see that a lot. And it was something that I was not used to seeing. And he was clearly losing his mind, and it was a very scary thing. And, you know, as he started going faster, I knew that there, I remember thinking to myself, should I jump? Should I jump? And I saw the rate of speed. I can still see looking down and seeing the pavement and thinking, if I jump, I'm not going to live. I'm not going to live. Well, I was stuck. You know, it was, I was there for the ride.
So how far away did he take you?
Hey, well, he took me across the state line, which made it a federal offense. And he eventually ended up into the woods and crashing the van into trees that he said could bend like rubber, but they were not bending like rubber. They, he just kept driving deeper and deeper into these woods. And I remember the sun going down. It's amazing the things you observe when you are thinking your life is coming to an end. Simple things that we don't observe every day that are 26 years later very, very clear to me. And
so let's fast forward a little bit, because I'm sure everybody listening to this show, especially some of those I know that are survivors that are in the chat room tonight, we can just imagine how it all ended. And we do know how most of it did end. But later in 88, he received a prison sentence. Was that based on charges that you or Adrian put forth, or?
Excuse me? Could you repeat that? I'm sorry, I could not hear it.
And later, I think it was December of 1988 or the beginning of 89, he received a 12-year prison sentence for many different accounts. But was that based on charges that you put forth or Adrian put forth, or was that on somebody else?
There actually was two six-year sentences running consecutively. The major charges were trying to kill a police officer, trying to outrun law enforcement, running across state lines. So you had 6 years from the state of Georgia, 6 years from the state of South Carolina, and ironically, he had held a insurance seminar hostage prior to the high-speed chase. And all of those hostages, one person suffered a heart attack. And, of course, one lady never bounced back from it, you know, suffering a lot of mental. Because, I mean, the same shotgun was used on them, and she never bounced back. I personally got the pleasure of meeting her and talking to her. So it, oddly enough, those charges kind of fell under the wayside. Mostly it was the trying to, you know, hurt a police officer and outrunning police and through two states.
So with all of those charges, I mean, throughout his years, he's been arrested as probably more times than he's been married. The number of charges against him And he was in prison until February 27th, 1991, I believe. As a victim at the hands of anybody, forget the fact that he's a celebrity. But because of his celebrity, how in the world do you handle it each day when you know that President Bush pardoned him?
Oh, my God. That was the worst night of my life, because we had fought so hard to stop him receiving the award, the Kennedy Honor. So many women's groups had jumped up and fought so hard to stop that, and I had to watch that knowing that there were victims on my shoulders that had come since my rape, and he received a pardon only a couple of weeks from the state of South Carolina of any and all charges, a full pardon. In other words, he had a completely clean slate after battering and hurting women. It was all gone. It was all gone, and he stood up there and received the award for peace, peace and nonviolence, the Kennedy Award.
And then a year after he was released from prison, the Grammy Awards gave him a Lifetime Achievement Award. So it almost seemed as if every time he did something wrong, it's almost, it's kind of, in hindsight, kind of like where we're at now with all the celebrities that continue to do wrong and yet get praised for it or get a huge paycheck for it. Back then in the 80s, this man, he was arrested so many times on aggravated assault, rape, alleged rape. You know, I got to keep saying alleged because we'll get to that in a minute. But, you know, all of these horrible crimes, especially towards a police officer, and yet our own President Bush in 2005 gives him a full pardon, and the Grammy Awards gives him a Lifetime Achievement Award.
You know, what was really sad was when he got the, when Mr. Bush, we had contacted Washington, they were well aware of, even to the Kennedy Center, personally had spoken to them about my case. I had personally sent them everything on my rape. They received it all. They chose to look the other way. They went ahead and forged ahead and gave it to him. And I told them, I said, what is so sad about this is he's going to hurt someone again, right? You're going to give this to him and he's going to hurt someone. And it wasn't 2 months later that he brutally assaulted his wife and tried to kill her with the cast iron chair. And he was arrested and charged again. And it was so sad to watch that night. It was probably one of the loneliest nights of my life because I went alone and I turned the TV on because I had to see it to believe it. I couldn't believe that this was happening, that I was in the United States of America, that I was a victim, that I was a woman, and I was having to watch the man that raped me accept the highest award that this country could give and to stand with the President of the United States. That was one of the lowest points in my life, truly, as a victim. That's, I think, when I decided things have got to change for women. Things have got to change here. Voices have got to be heard above above the icons. There needs to be an icon law, because when I got raped, there were no high-profile cases. There were no women's groups like there are today, and we still have so far to go. But that was a turning point for me that night. And we still, there needs to be icon laws, because what I went up against was an icon, not just a United States icon, not just a man that was known in Germany, Japan. I went up against a man that the world, every city, every country hailed him an icon and a god. And
the godfather of soul.
Yes. I mean, it was me, just a girl up against that much worldwide power. To survive just him alone was a feat. To stand up and face the world was, it has been shoes that, trust me, have been very difficult and very hard to walk in and to live in. Very hard.
The guest call-in number for some of the people in the chat room asking is 347-838-8622. Again, that number is 347-838-8622. When you call in, please say that you'd like to go in the host queue, and then we'll know that you're here to ask a question and not just listen to the show. Just to clarify, Donald Rosen, he's still one of your attorneys, correct?
Yes. Been with me.
Okay, and then
15 years,
and then Buddy Dallas was Brown's attorney back then. Is he still overseeing the state today?
He's not overseeing the state. He is still very close to me. He went up against me, oddly enough, for 25 years, and but is very much a part of my team in the federal courts.
Okay. And then, so that we clarify and set the record straight, I forget what her name was, but in 2005, there was an attorney that told media that a judge in Los Angeles had declared you frivolous. I never knew you had been in a courtroom in Los Angeles. Am I missing something here? Because I did a lot of research. I'm telling you, Jackie, I've never done so much research for a show before, but I'm thinking, wait a second, she was never in court in Los Angeles. How did a judge declare that? So what's true?
Okay. The attorney was Deborah Opry, famed Deborah Opry. She represented James Brown in the case I took to federal court on the rape. She represented Larry Burkhead in the Anna Nicole Smith case. Actually, our cases were going exactly at the same time. She was representing both people. It was me and Anna up against her. And she told the world that I had been found frivolous by a judge in L.A. and that the judge had agreed with a Chicago lawyer in federal court here that I was frivolous. First of all, the judge in the Chicago federal court, there was like a frivolous. The judge was simply, it was a 2-year statute of limitations. As far as L.A., I have never been in a courtroom in L.A. I had never been in a case in L.A. The only case that has just now been filed is my case for the trust. It was just an outright lie that went all over the world.
That people believe because it comes
from
a reputable source, so everyone assumes.
Yes.
It's called what I like to think of as character assassination, when you're not even claiming. If you're going to be in media, deliver the truth. or don't deliver it, you know. So, but
well,
I wanted to, because I could not understand when I found that today. I was like, huh? But let's dig a little bit deeper, and if I get to an area, just let me know. But, you know, Brown died of heart failure December 25th, 2006, ironically on Christmas, no less, at the age of 73, I believe. Both he and Michael Jackson had so many common denominators, but one major common denominator was that their doctor was Conrad Murray, the doctor which is under investigation on Jackson's death. Do you know anything about Murray and how he played a factor in Brown's life or possibly Brown's death? Hello?
Yes, I do. I do know about that. And I, at this moment in time, I cannot comment on it.
Okay.
Because of some investigations going on. But there, yes, I do have information on that.
Okay. So we'll bypass that right now. You know, many victims tend to last a lifetime going through hell with Stockholm Syndrome, etc. And many victims turn into survivors and do things about it. You've had the Coalition Against Sexual Assault, which is in every state. In this case, it was the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And even the Navy SEALs come and have your back. You went to the White House. You had laws passed. In particular, I want our listeners to hear some of the good stuff that this bad situation came about. So, like, on HB 1462, tell us a little bit about that and where it's at now.
HB 1462 came about because I argued it all the way to the United States Supreme Court on the rape case. The 11th Circuit Court, the wonderful judges up there realized or told me that I was a precedented case. And there was a female judge in the 11th Circuit that I remember sitting in there with the Navy SEALs around me. And I remember the judge saying to me, "You are a precedent, and there is no case like yours in the world here. So you can make a difference." And she basically, I didn't really catch on to what she was saying, but then one of the SEALs leans into my ear and he goes, "I know where she's going. You can take this case. She has opened the door to the United States Supreme Court." And it was what I argued, the estoppel on an attacker or a rapist or a victim being harassed and silenced into fear and not being, you know, the statute of limitations, not allowing you when you have been, like I was, you know, harassed, intimidated, made to believe you would die if you went into court. And now in the state of Illinois, there is no statute because of my law. It has opened the door, and a victim, be it a child, be it a man, be it a woman, of anyone that has been assaulted and raped, as with the priest that have assaulted children, and 20 to 25 years later, they look up and they go, "I have strength now. I can come into court." The doors are open for them. It was the greatest day of my life when that law passed. I went before the testified at the legislature, at the Senate. I remember when I first wanted to go with the law. ICASA told me, this wonderful lawyer there, Lynn Shalette, said, "You realize that this bill could take 15 years. The magnitude of it could take us 15 years. Be prepared. And, of course, it passed unanimously. We took my case, my evidence of my case. We presented it to the legislature. We presented it to the Senate, and it passed unanimously. And it was the that was everything to me. That was the greatest day of my life. That is my legacy.
And they are the voice of the people. So obviously, the people have spoken. Kind of like the O.J. Simpson case that somebody's referencing in the chat room, you know, the public, the people know the truth. And so maybe that's a little bit of support that can make victims feel at ease knowing that legislators are having a voice for the victims. How have you, there's a couple questions in the chat room. How are you dealing with the rape? And do you have any issues having a man in your life since April 1st, 1988?
I'll take the first one first. How am I dealing with it? I am not ashamed to say it's 26 years later. I still go to therapy every week. I have for 26 years. I've never missed an appointment in all those years. It's very important to me. I'm under the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Violence. I had some of the best doctors who have dealt with post-traumatic stress disorder on the military end. I will tell you that I was a Navy SEAL who was very high up, who trained the Navy SEALs, did step in. He became my right-hand person, and he worked with building me back, and he worked for years on a day-to-day basis because I was a cowering, shell-shocked individual who was very afraid, and he made me fight. He made me, there were weak times where he literally jerked me up, made me fight. He would scream at me, go ahead, ring the bell. When the press were really hard on me and I had never talked to them, he would scream at me, get up, get up, get up. He forced me to run. He forced me to become strong. I'm grateful for all my therapists that have worked with me. What I understand is that the rape caused my mind to shatter my brain, and it was something that I don't think the world knew through the 26 years. The girl that went into the woods did not come back out. I did not come back out. I think I died in there. I think that he murdered my soul in there, and I no longer saw the sun. I no longer saw life. Everything became black and white and cold. My brain didn't function the way a normal person's brain functioned after I came out, because I was in a state of shock. And the pain was so great that at one point I asked him to please just kill me, to get it over with and just to kill me so the pain wouldn't continue on. So the answer to that question is, how do I deal with it, is I take each day at a time. I have a lot of wonderful friends on Facebook that talk to me. I have
they must all be in the chat room because they there's a lot of people saying they love you, and I believe there's a lady by the name of Shirley in the chat room that has your back. So you've got your fan club in the chat room tonight. And I think somebody also may have a question for you, so let's see if they got through. Hold on 1 minute. Caller from the 917 area, you're on the line. Do you have a question for Jackie?
Yes, I am. I'm a friend of hers. My name is Paul.
You what?
Hello?
Yes, hi. This is Paul. I'm a friend of Jackie.
Hi. Hello.
Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Paul.
Hi.
Well,
hi, how are you?
Do you have a question for Jackie?
Yes, I do. Of all that you've been through over the years with dealing with the James Brown case and dealing with all the issues you've had with the government and stuff like that, I know you've had issues recently with a gentleman by the name of Scott Bernstein. Could you talk a little about that?
Oh, well, I think that has been played. There's no doubt that a lot of people in Facebook know about that. This man, and I think this has to come to do with trust. I accepted somebody claiming to be security in my life. It is very important for me to have security with what I'm going through. And I picked somebody off of Facebook that told me they were the best. And, of course, I trusted that person. And it ended up I was extorted for $80,000 and threatened. And my life was threatened. And the past 3 or 4 months have been very difficult living.
Why does that name sound so familiar?
Is
he on the media? Or?
Yes, he
claimed. Hasn't he been on television or something?
Yes, with the Scott. He worked with Court TV in some way. With Court TV with the Scott Peterson murder case in California.
He was arrested for impersonating a police officer numerous times, and he's actually on Facebook, and there are a lot of, oddly enough, a lot since my case with him trying to extort money from me. He seems to play on a lot of victims of missing children and gets money up front, tells them he can find the kid. Of course, he never does. And I feel very bad for people that play on victims. I'm a victim. I'm a survivor, but I'm a victim. I never lose the word victim from my name because that's where it all started. I am a survivor, but I will always be who I was, and I'm not ashamed to say it. But people with missing children, oh, my God. Oh, my God. A mother's heart, a father's heart, to lose a child and to have a man saying, I will find your child, give me $2,000 on Facebook. They put their trust into that person. And this is a man who does not have a license to practice. I did not know that. He does not have a license to practice. He does not have a license to be out finding those children. And these people are just losing money. And it's very, very sad.
You know what I'd like to, caller, thank you for your question this evening. Our phones are lighting up. What I'd like to do, Jackie, is if you can email me some information on that individual, we can definitely have our private investigator and such look into him. But let's move the show back to you, because I find this story and your history so compelling. And the more I read and research on your case, the more I get upset with why it is you're a victim and yet so many people are judging you and re-victimizing you. And that's why we want to have a voice for justice this evening. We have somebody else from the Illinois area calling in. Caller, do you have a question for Jackie this evening?
Me?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I just wanted to tell Jackie. Jackie is currently is producing me, and I just want to tell her I love her.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for calling in. We appreciate you listening. And are you a performer?
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, make sure we know when you're going to be unveiling, what is it, an album?
Jesse is CD? Doing a little secret here since Jesse is on. I actually wrote a song for all the victims, and the record already has her song. The song already has a record label, and it's going to go out, and it's going to raise money for the rape victims across America. So this is the singer for it, and we have been working very hard every day getting her ready for this.
Well, wonderful, wonderful. Well, thank you for calling in, Jesse, and definitely make sure that you let us know when that releases. We'll spread the word.
All right.
Thank
love
you so
Jesse.
Much.
Thank you.
I love you.
I love you too,
thank
sweetie. What a sweet kid.
She sounds young, Jackie.
She's very young.
How old is she?
Look at. She's like,
how old is she?
16.
Oh, wow. Wonderful, wonderful. Well, so you're taking a bad situation and making something good out of it, like empowering, like Jesse. You know, she's 16 and looking up to you. I think that is wonderful. I want to make sure that many of the people, because I know they're your fan club there, it appears in the chat room, and any listeners listening, I'm not shunning this Scott Bernstein situation, we promise we will look into him, and if he is appearing on any of the networks that we work with or the TV shows, we'll make sure that producers of those shows understand that. You know, we do a lot, my company, with families of kidnapped children, and I'll tell you, I have seen my share of phony balonies. And it is, you're right, it's not a good thing for families when they open their hearts and souls to somebody. I believe you and I have spoken about a particular individual who's really an actor but claims to be a publicist. But, you know, in hindsight, though, there's more good people out there than bad. And we need to see it that way, because like the folks at the Coalition Against Sexual Assault, they're having a voice for you, and they're there supporting you. And I know with this trust, which is worth over $100 million or something of that nature,
it's almost
that could help a lot of underprivileged. Pardon me?
It's very well close to billion. And the thing that bothers me the most is that every day I have to walk, I have to look around, I have to see the tears in the children's eyes, I have to see the tears in the people on my Facebook. I have the most wonderful Facebook friends in the world, all over the world. And I receive letters of families losing their homes. I receive letters of missing children, friends of mine that are having bake sales and trying to sell a couple of cakes to raise money to pay for investigators. I have a very dear friend of mine, her name is Kathy, who is a wonderful person who hunts for missing children through helicopters and
We love Kathy.
Yes.
We love Angels Wings Search and Rescue.
Yes.
They are fabulous.
And, you know, they need money, and, you know, the abused children, they're, they need money. And in these 4 years, not one penny, not one penny has been given to any one person. And it has been a four-year struggle in the federal courts for me. But I know that I am the only one who can walk through the door and carry in the proof, because I am the only one with it. And
you do. You have proof. You have documentation.
Yes.
You are the co-founder of that.
Yes.
And what I think bothers me the most, and I guess maybe I should have gone in, to be an attorney, maybe. I don't know. But in this particular case, his family and his children were so very distant from his life for so many years. And so for them to be coming out of the woodwork, and they've all been, they've all had their issues too, but money is the root of all evil. And if this man wanted you to have nothing to do with that before he died, I guarantee you he would have made sure that all paperwork would have omitted you from all legal documents. He did not do that. So for me, I would be the best kind of juror on that jury, because I see so much money that he's put his effort into being a good singer. He might have been a bad man at times, and let's give him the benefit of the doubt. You know, he did utilize some form of drugs. So, but he had a passion and he had a drive for that money to be used for good, for those underprivileged, especially children. And we're talking a lot of good could come from that trust account. So
well,
kudos to you, girl, for pushing that through. But let me ask you, and I know you're in litigation and all of that, but do you regret having a voice or having that last voice trying to get that trust account back to where it needs to be?
Well, I knew Mr. Brown so well. As when he died, and I received a phone call telling me that the trust, he had given everything as he had promised me years earlier. I was not really shocked. I was shocked at the amount, but I wasn't shocked because he knew that is what I did, was see to it that people, that my whole career had basically been working with the poor and needy, our country's veterans, children's charities. And I think he knew in his heart I would fight. I need to say this. I never thought that I could be able to say that I forgave him for what he did to me. But through the years and to now, after he passed away, I have come to forgive him, because I have since learned that he suffered a great deal over what he did to me. When you're a victim, of course, you hate. You hate because you've been hurt. I fought up against this man for 25 years. I think he was shocked that I was able to fight him for 25 years. But he knew me. This is a man who made me. He molded me. I worked with him for years prior to the incident. You had to be strong to work with James Brown, the Godfather of Soul. you had to be the best to stand beside him. You couldn't be a mediocre musician and work with this man. You would have never made it, not for 5 minutes. So in the later years after he passed, I learned to forgive, and I realized that I had a position, and that position was the people, the children, the victims that I see all the time, my girls from CASA, the rape victims across the United States, our law enforcement who can't afford vests, people abused. They became the, I guess you would say, they became the gold in my heart. They became the wings. They became my strength. They became my reason to fight. And they are every day what keeps me going through the courts. And I hope one day to turn around and say, here, this is for all of you. This is the 100%. It is all yours. Please, make a difference. Take this, which was what was mine, what was his, and make a difference in this country and around where there is so much suffering and so much pain, like what I went through for 25 years. If I can change that for one human being, oh my God, it would be my life, my legacy, and everything I ever wanted, to not see suffering, to not see pain. Yeah,
with Thanksgiving tomorrow?
Yes.
With Thanksgiving tomorrow, how do you reflect on the 26 years that you've gone through? And I know you and I spoke earlier, you know, the flashbacks, the nightmares, that continue, the 26 years of therapy you're still in. With all the victims and survivors listening tonight, what kind of message can you give them, and what are you thankful for tonight?
Oh, gosh. Well, I'm very thankful that God has carried me for 26 years against an awful lot of loneliness, an awful lot of pain. I'm very thankful that that night in the woods, I thought I was going to die, and I asked God to please let me live. And he did that. I did not ask God to make it an easy road for me, and he did not. But I've realized that through these 26 years that he has laid a reason for me. It went from the rape to much, much sorrow, much pain of trying to see my attacker through the court systems. And then he turned around and gave a half of a rainbow with HB 1462 coming about and making it different for rape victims for the rest of eternity in the state of Illinois. And then he turned around and filled the other half of the rainbow with a trust. And so I am very thankful for my life, and I'm very thankful that God chose me to pave this road. And I'm very thankful for the people that support me, and thankful that that my life has, with all its sorrow, with all its pain, has been something I can turn around and say has been worthwhile, hopefully, for everybody.
We have a caller on the line. Unidentified caller, you're on the air. Do you have a question for Jackie this evening?
Yes, I do. My name is Grace, and
I'm really thankful for Jackie being a voice for us kids in the world. And to us, she's a hero.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, sweetheart.
Thank you.
Where are you from?
Alabama.
Alabama.
Alabama,
wow. You're a long way away. Thank you for your kind words and for taking your Thanksgiving and listening to me. That is really sweet. And it means a lot to me, and for your calling me what you did. I am very, very humbled by it because it just really touches me. Thank you.
Thank you, Grace, and you have a beautiful name. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
What a cutie patootie.
Gosh,
what a cutie. We have about 19 minutes remaining, so if anyone has a question for Jackie, please feel free and call in at 347-838-8622. Just to start closing the show, we know that following Thanksgiving, much stuff will come to light on some certain issues, etc. Is there anything that you want to discuss, or do you have any last thoughts before we close tonight?
Well, you know, I still have I have the, you know, the roads I'm blocking for the trust, and I'm working on this for the victims, and Christmas is upon us, and of course that is the
time. Is Christmas a difficult time for you?
You know, yes it is. A very very difficult time. You know, I remember, you know, of course, when I was woke up out of my sleep and told about 4 o'clock in the morning by my lawyer that I needed to wake up, and I thought it was rather odd because my lawyer had never called me at that hour, had never ever called me and wished me Merry Christmas either, and you know how you're asleep, and of course, I had been having a very difficult time that week, and I won't go into it, but he woke me up and said he needed for me to sit on the side of the bed. He had something he had to tell me, and he said he's dead. And I didn't know who he was talking about, and I thought that he was going to tell me the United States Supreme Court had made a decision with my writ in the Supreme Court, and thought that was coming. And of course, you know, he said, I said, who's dead? And of course, his words were, James Brown is dead. And we don't know what has happened. I've just gotten a call, and it has not been released to the world or to the public. They wanted you to know immediately. And I understand that I guess I blacked out. I don't know, really recall what happened. It was 25 years coming down on me. And here I was, had made it to the highest court in the, you know, in the land. And it was God. And of course, within, you know, less than an hour, there wasn't a phone that didn't stop ringing. So there was no Christmas for me that day. There was many emotions. There were calls coming from all over the world. CNN started running immediately, and they ran for 2 weeks. I mean, it did not stop. We had a president that died, and he was put behind James Brown, and James Brown's life and career was, you could go nowhere. I mean, the radios, the computers, the televisions, the stores. I had to walk in stores and hear his music. I had, there was just no way of getting away from it. It was, and I didn't believe he was dead. It was very difficult for me. Many, many emotions went through. So Christmas is a difficult time for me. Hard for me.
I know. I was raped on October 31st, 1992, in Denver, Colorado. And I'll tell you, I never enjoyed Halloween ever until 4 years ago when my beautiful niece was born on Halloween. And so what used to be a very dark holiday for me, even though it's a dark holiday anyway, my niece was born, and that Isabella is the joy of my life. So it's ironic how some bad situations, the light is not too far away from good. With that, we have a couple callers on the line. Caller from the 239 area code, you're on the air. Do you have a question for Jackie?
Actually, I have just a statement or two to make. My name is Sandy, and I'm in Naples, Florida. And I've been a Facebook friend for Jacques through actually a friend, Sherry Gaines, as my friend. And so I've kept up with a little bit, and I just wanted to say how courageous throughout all these years. Your courage, Jacques, is amazing. The perseverance, it would not, all of this good that has come from this evil would not have come without, I think, God's strength in giving you that perseverance. And I am praying that you have complete healing. You've got good people, people that love you. I see this all over, so that you can, I guess, just keep moving forward. It's amazing the strength that you've got to do this and all the good that you are helping for people. And we pray that that trust fund goes for those kids. Just an amazing, amazing things, Jacques, that you've done. One of the few people that can get through something like this and have so much good come from it. That God's blessings to you. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. And
thank you so much for calling.
Thank you for supporting me. It's very kind of you.
Oh, no problem.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you.
Thanksgiving.
Uh-huh. Bye.
Bye.
We have another caller. I think they're calling from Las Vegas. Caller, you're on the air. Do you have a question for Jackie?
Yes, I do, and I feel like you're my sisters because I was a rape victim also, and just like Jackie, it was in Chicago, 1968, by a doctor, and he threatened me for life if I would say anything, and he said he'd put me in an insane asylum, and he had witnesses, and it was kind of a long thing. Anyways, I never talked about it for 40 years, and then I went back to school to write, and I start writing my memoirs, and I was able to write like a half a sentence, and it was like finally it came out. And my question, Jackie, is what was your epiphany where finally after 20 years something triggered off in your head that said, I can start talking about this and I should. And I'm grateful and I'm very thankful on this Thanksgiving that you're doing this talking and having this show because this needs to be exposed. But what made you open up after 20 years?
You know, I haven't, I don't know if it was, I guess it was after the law and a lot of questions coming to my Facebook. I really opened Facebook up as a just a place, like most people. I didn't realize that so many people worldwide had questions for me. I was kind of taken back at the reception that people knew who I was. I mean, I was like, wow, these people know, and I didn't think, and so I started realizing that I was answering questions and talking to victims on chat, and then, of course, I was asked to do this show, and I decided to do it. I had not really ever gone public. I've never been on a national show. I have never sat down with a national reporter. I have just lived a very quiet life, even though I see NBC, CBS, CNN, all writing about me. Never talked to them, so it just felt like a good time. It was Thanksgiving, and I was asked by Michelle. I just felt like a time to come out.
Mm-hmm. What there's two other things, like once I was able to write about it and then talk about it or even mention like to my family or friends or something, even in today's day and age, you still get this, like, I feel a cold shoulder, like you shouldn't talk about it, or you should feel sorry for him and forgive him. And it's like, wait a minute, I've been suffering inside mentally for and emotionally for 40 years, and there, I don't feel that empathy.
You know, you will get to that point. I suffered a horrendous attack, and you know, you find a place, and God, He works in mysterious ways. 10 years ago, 11 years ago, if you had asked me, would I ever forgive this man, I would have looked at you and I would have said, you're crazy. I could not. There was, and that's what a lot of people don't realize with rape victims. You go through years, and these courts are foolish. And a lot, I don't want to bash the media, but a lot of the media who don't have a lot of training in rape don't realize that in law enforcement that it, every rape victim is different. Some can go 30 years before they can even remotely speak or talk about it. Some can be able to talk 5 years later. It is how your mind and your healing comes. I've just been very blessed. 26 years is a very long road. But I, a lot of my friends on Facebook helped me, and of course the Navy SEALs and our country's veterans and law enforcement that worked with me. People would say, well, where have you been all this time? What have you been doing? I was in therapy. I was having the eggs unscrambled in my head by the Navy SEALs. I was becoming strong to the point. I was listening and learning and realizing that, you know, hate is like a cancer and it eats you. And and vengeance is not good either. Vengeance is horrible, horrible, horrible. It's like a disease, and it you can't have that. You need to, you know, you have to forgive someone because they're sick. They it's hard to get to that point, but I did. I did last year, and now I can go on, and I hope I can make a difference, and I know that time will come for you. It will come for you, I promise. And you will feel, you will look around, and the sun will shine again for you. and it won't be black and white anymore. And a lot of people say, well, I didn't get justice. But it's not always about justice. As a victim, you learn to walk with your scars like I have. And
justice is living.
That's right.
You know,
and
justice is living and not letting all of the darkness win. And that's how you get justice to the person, persons, or thing that has darkened part of your world.
You know,
well,
a Navy SEAL said to me,
one of the things that I did was I got some cassette tapes that it talks about people, women that have sexual problems. And it says that there must have been a trauma in your life. And it says, write a letter to the person that hurt you and write everything out and then burn it and just say that this is out of your life. And because 40 years had gone by, it's like so numbing, you know. I could just put it aside and just say, forget it. But if the person is still alive, do you think I should write a letter explaining my hurt, or just, you know, I haven't heard from him or anything like in all these years. Just let it go, just like burning that letter, that imaginary letter that I wrote, just let it go.
Can I tell
you
something?
Are you in counseling?
No, because it was a counselor that raped me.
But
oh,
can I tell you
rough.
Something? I'm listening to you right now, and I really hear, and I know your pain, and I feel it, but listen to your voice, and you are already speaking out, and you're already there, and you just spoke about what happened to you, and to me that's standing, and to me that is the bird coming out of the cage, and you weren't afraid.
Well, well,
and I'm
you
so
know
proud
what?
Of you. You're
well,
doing
Jackie,
it.
Jackie, I'm the widow of a U.S. Marine Purple Heart also.
How far out?
So,
that is so cool.
I don't know, maybe some of that strength being with him all those years kind of rubbed off on me a little bit, but
I love the veteran
very, very much. Yeah, my husband was in Vietnam and got a Purple Heart and everything, so.
Well, I just want to remind, you know, the listeners, you know, myself and also Jackie, we're not doctors or professionals. So back to the question regarding writing a letter,
mm-hmm.
it worked for me because my so-called friend is still alive. It did work for me, but you need to be ready for whatever comes if you do that. But that's an individual preference, I think. Am I saying that right, Jackie?
You know, I wrote many letters, and I wrote hundreds of letters, thousands probably, through these years, and went to sleep and cried and walked the floors at night and lived in constant fear. Moving, I just think that every rape victim is different, and I think that this caller to me sounds like she's sitting on the perch and flying and standing, and I am one of these people that believe all rape victims should be heard. They should all of them speak. And there will be 1,000 voices singing throughout the world. If every rape victim could find the courage, Christmas time, to speak out and to be heard somewhere, oh my gosh, it would be the most beautiful sound throughout the world. Every single one of them on one night should all sing out. And what a beautiful sound, because they would all be ready to fly.
I would agree there.
That.
I believe if we've all band together, I think there's more of us than them. And if, you know, all the survivors came together, boy, what a sight that would be.
Wasn't it that neat? I'd love
Thank you, caller.
I'd love to host it with you, Michelle.
He'd like to host it with me. We have another call from the Las Vegas area code. We have about, we've added 30 minutes onto the show, and the show will have now gone 2 hours, but obviously there's a lot to be discussed, and I commend all of those that have called in this evening, and especially the younger kids, very impressive, and know that there's organizations and many community organizations in your local area. Partner with them. Get involved. Caller, you're on the air from the 702 area code. Do you have a question?
Hello. This is
Hello?
Alan from Vegas. I'm a friend of Jackie's. And
hi, Alan.
Hi. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody. I just wanted to say that Jackie is just a wonderful spirit. I've heard her story for about 4 hours one night. I've been, you know, with her virtually and on the phone literally almost 3 months. Is it about three months? No, three months. I've been... on top of this case of hers, you know, trying to support her, you know, talk to her, try to get a hold of other people. You know, we've run into some shady people along the way. And, you know, I'm just amazed at how she's dealing with all this through all these years. And,
it's amazing. She's definitely a survivor.
No, more needs to be done from what I've seen. A lot of people, it takes a long time for things to get done. Jurisdiction problems are... a major issue in trying to get these people, these punks, you know, these misdemeanors and plea deals and you name it. It's just the system is broken, and I've heard that from other people as well, you know, and people just need to band together. And they need to fight for the changes. You know, Obama said this is the year for change. Okay, let's go and do it. We got enough people out there. Communication, that's always been an issue with the different departments, even though as well, you know, I don't want to... like bash law enforcement, et cetera, it seems to be a constant issue.
No, we don't want to do that. We work closely with them.
You know, and that's just it's a slap in a way in the face of the victims.
Well, thank you for calling in, Alan.
Okay.
I hope the weather's a lot warmer in Vegas than it is here in Portland, but thank you for calling. Happy Thanksgiving to you, sir.
Thanksgiving to you, Alan. Thank you. Another Facebook friend.
Wow.
That I've never met.
Amazing. Say that again.
Another Facebook friend that I've never met, but has really just always credits really nice things on my Facebook. So I can truthfully say I'm one of the lucky people that has the greatest Facebook friends in the world. Oh, my goodness. What a group.
Well, definitely Facebook and Twitter and social media really has opened the doors of staying connected. But definitely we do need to make sure that know who you're speaking to. because there's always somebody trying to break you out there, and I don't mean to be Debbie Downer, but I don't mean to be Debbie Downer, but if our listeners tonight see our last show that we did, you'll see that it's amazing how people can convince thousands of people they're somebody they are that they aren't. So, but I also wanted to say, I know I see Deborah Davis in the chat room this evening. Our next show is December 8th. Author Deborah Davis will be on the air with us, and she too is a survivor, and we'll be talking again on that. We may do a show next Wednesday for National AIDS Awareness Day. excuse me. But I'm not, we might have to postpone that for another meeting that we have coming up. But I do have one more caller calling in from the 609 area code. Caller, you're on the air. Do you have a question for Jackie?
I just wanted to tell Jackie, as a friend, I'm very proud of her for what she's doing. And she knows that she always has me on her side.
Thank you. And what's your name?
Thank you. That's a
Keith Shemek.
He's a law enforcement officer. A very good
thank
one.
You,
and
Keith.
I thank you so much for calling in.
You're a law enforcement officer, sir?
Yes, I am.
While we have you on the air, let me ask you one quick question, if I may. Where are you a law enforcement officer?
In New Jersey.
In New Jersey. You know, with the ongoing epidemic and increase of violences against women, can you give our listeners tonight any advice as to really, we all know that if you get abused, you really should report it. But any advice for our listeners tonight on how they can take control and the empowerment when something happens to them versus many of us that wait many years?
Well, they need to report it as soon as possible. There are tests to be performed. There are things to be performed. A lot of evidence can be lost on a wait. People need to be aware. Law enforcement needs to be aware of the individuals that are out there on the street that think they can get away with stuff like this. But the main thing is, people must report this as soon as possible. Forget about the embarrassment, the degradation, anything. It has to be reported. And the faster it's reported, the faster things get done, evidence is not lost, and then justice will have to take its course from there.
I would think there's a lot of differences between today with DNA testing and such than 26 years ago. Can somebody that's been violated preserve DNA and evidence without looking like, why did they do that?
They need to report as fast as they can. Get to a hospital, get to anything, let them perform the test, let them secure the evidence for the DNA testing. And it has to go from there.
How long, somebody's asking in the chat room, see Keith, you came on the air, you know, everybody loves to talk to law enforcement. How long can a rape be reported? Is there a statute on a rape?
In New Jersey, I'm not sure of the statute. I think it can go on for as long as it can be. I would say, as soon as possible to report it. Get it on the record. Get it on the books. Get the report in. Let law enforcement do their job. And they will. If we're given enough time and we're given the opportunity to do it and act on it, we will do our job.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for calling in this evening, and happy Thanksgiving, and definitely keep up the great job. We love our men and women in law enforcement. Without
you,
these crimes wouldn't come to an end. So thank you so much. Well, Jackie, I know that we've extended this a little bit, but final words before we go this evening?
I think if I had one wish, I would ask for two. One would be that the trust goes through for everybody. And the second one would be what I told my doctor, excuse me, that I would like to see for rape victims and for victims, and that all hospitals, I know when I went to the hospital, it was very, very scary, and it was very, very cold, and the room was very sterile, and I felt so scared and so alone, and I wish for all hospitals to make a room that is just for rape victims, that when they come in, it's not cold and it's not sterile. No evidence is going to be lost. They're going to be in that room. But make it a very pink room and a very tranquil room. And don't have everybody running at them like they did me. And make it a room where the victim can come down. That was the problem. And I think rape victims need a chance to come down if they're not showering and they're sitting there. They've got time to come down and rest and to be given something warm. I just wanted something warm. I wanted to feel safe. I wanted to feel that I was okay. I was so scared, and I hope that hospitals will do this throughout the United States and all over the world, is to consider rape victims a very traumatic experience and to have that room available in every hospital that is filled with love and bears and something they can hold and quiet music, that something that will bring them back to a better place, and that they're safe and no longer, they're no longer a victim. They are a human being, and they're not being judged, and they're not being looked at and stared at with all the eyes that were staring at me. And I pray for that throughout, and that's what I want to do, is to see to it those rooms are everywhere across the world, and that rape victims take a higher stand in this world and are seen as our heroes, and because it takes a heck of a lot of courage to be a victim and to become a survivor, and they have fought one heck of a war, and my hat is off to them all across the world. And I love you all. I love you all.
Thank you, Jackie. For our listeners also, especially in the New York area, Mariska Hargitay, who we all know, Olivia Benson on Law & Order SVU, she started an organization many years ago called the Joyful Heart Foundation. It's located in New York, and it is a wonderful organization to help. It's almost similar to what Jackie's speaking of for a room when a rape victim goes to a hospital. They have an organization that helps sexually assault victims with different types of services, and it's a wonderful organization. And so to put in a plug for them, again, look up the Joyful Heart Foundation. Tell them you heard about it here on Voices for Justice, and definitely have a voice for all rape victims. I know that they've been diligent, as well as many other organizations like Soroptimus International, on one particular law that needs to be passed, and that is rape kits that sit forever on shelves and then the DNA and evidence is lost. So there's still so much work to be done, but when we have epidemics like this and human trafficking and other heinous violence crimes against women and girls and boys as well, that we find ourselves not being able to stand up to the test of time, and we find that we're not able to keep up with what is happening. And so unfortunately, you know, we need to make sure that we're changing our shift and changing laws and things of that nature as things are coming, because it's only getting worse. And the longer we put it on a shelf, the longer it's going to take us to remove it. So, Jackie, thank you so much for being with us this evening. And we're going to end with a show from a very dear good friend of mine, Sue Riney. She is the governor of Soroptimus International, the Northwestern region. She has recorded all good gifts from God's spell for the closure of our show this evening. And I leave you with saying thank you, Jackie. Thank you to everybody that tuned in. Have a very happy and safe Thanksgiving. And what will you do this week to make a difference in your community? We all have the ability to be the voice for justice. Thank you to all of our callers also this evening. And again, thank you and happy Thanksgiving. Here's Sue Riney.
Which thou desirest, our humble, thankful hearts.